Well, good afternoon and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian, and I'm so pleased that so many of you did brave the cold weather. Yesterday, Old Man Winter surprised all of us, I think, including the library staff, when we were here yesterday running the library. We got a little worried when the snow started coming down late in the morning and continued through most of the day. But fortunately, we can all be here this afternoon to celebrate Irving Berlin and Alexander's Ragtime Band. I am Mark, the head librarian. I know most of you, and we have a couple of guests here as well. Welcome to the Rubens, I believe, who are visiting. And we also this afternoon were very pleased that Mary Ellen Barrett is able to be here, Irving Berlin's daughter. She's a member of our library, and her daughter Catherine as well, who is a member of the library. First, let me acknowledge the very generous support of the estate of Marion O. Naumburg. The Naumburg estate has allowed us to do a lot of special theatrical, musical, performance-related events here at the library, and we'll be able to do so for quite a few years. For any of you that might have a cell phone or a pager, if you can take it out at this point and just check that it's turned off, silenced, whatever you need to do to make sure it doesn't make noise over the next hour and a half, that would be wonderful. Let me introduce our performers. This afternoon is Come On and Hear, the 100th anniversary of Alexander's Ragtime Band. We are really so happy to be celebrating this 100th anniversary of such a great song. And it gives me great pleasure to welcome back a very good friend of the library's, Michael Lasser, who is the author of America's Song, the stories behind the songs of Broadway, Hollywood, and Tin Pan Alley. We do have copies of his book this afternoon, and they'll be available for sale outside. And Michael tells me he's more than happy to sign one for you. And joining Michael this afternoon is the library's very own Sarah Holliday, who will be singing for us, and on piano, Brenna Sage. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's nice to see you all. It's very nice to be back. And I hope you understand how hard it is to sit up here and not sing when the midnight choo-choo. Yeah, it really is very, it's a tribute to my restraint. You understand that we are here because in March of 1911, just over 100 years ago in terms of the year, Irving Berlin published a song that virtually changed American music, a song that is one of the best known and most beloved songs in our history, a song that millions of people can still sing every word to, and I guarantee most of you could. Some of you already started singing. I could hear things up here. And so we are here to celebrate. But there's more to it than candles on a cake. For starts, it's a ragtime song. We opened the program with three of the most famous ragtime songs. It took us a while. We finally did get to Irving Berlin. And the reason I did it that way, because there's a wonderful story about him. Once he had established himself as a songwriter, and he did that largely through ragtime songs, he went to London to appear at the Hippodrome Theater. He had done a little work in vaudeville on stage in that wonderfully reedy voice of his that you know from his singing of Oh, How I Hate to Get Up in the Morning, one of the great American songs, one of the great American comic songs. He went out on stage, and his act consisted of singing his songs. And at one point in the act, he asked for requests, and the audience would call out songs, and he would pick the one he wanted to sing, I guess, and do it. And then one night, people started calling out songs that he hadn't written, ragtime songs, but songs perhaps like Won't You Come Home, Bill Bailey, by Huey Cannon. And it dawned on him, they think I've written every ragtime song. And I will tell you that when you do the kinds of things that I do and you immerse yourself in American song, it sometimes truly does feel as if he wrote every song. Partly because he wrote so many wonderful songs, so many great songs, so many standards, but also because his range was so extraordinary, because he was so adept at so many kinds of songs. Only Gershwin could write a Gershwin song, but the person who wrote Gershwin songs almost as well as Gershwin was Irving Berlin. Only Porter could write what Porter did, but the only other person who could write almost as well in that vein was Irving Berlin. He was, in fact, a protean figure. I referred to him as our unlikeliest genius. And there's a story about the Berlins at home one night. You were there. The family was at the table, and Mrs. Berlin, Ellen Mackey, said to one of her daughters, "Dear," and you know you're in trouble when it starts with dear. When my father called me Michael, I knew I was in trouble. "Take your elbows off the table." And the child responded, I don't know which one it was, the child responded, "Daddy keeps his elbows on the table." And Mrs. Berlin said, "Yes, he does, dear, but that's different. Daddy's a genius." And so he was. And that genius began with ragtime songs, because ragtime was in the air. And Berlin, like the other songwriters of his many decades, except Berlin's gift was larger and deeper, it was a genius for America. The songs of the first half of the 20th century were not about the songwriters. Oh, some, of course, were personal. They had to be. You can't do that work every day and not have some of you come into them. but they were not generally an expression of a personal vision. They were not poets. They were songwriters. And I think it does a disservice to both to get into that fuzzy ground where suddenly Bob Dylan is a poet. No, he's not. He's a great songwriter. Berlin, of course, had some personal things in his songs, as they all did. But what the songwriters wrote about was not themselves. They wrote about us. If it was on our minds or in our hearts, it ended up in a popular song. Ragtime was in the air. It was the first defining sound of the 20th century, that ragged, broken, irresistible sound for a broken century to come. It was a time of shattering almost everything. But ragtime initially was an instrumental music that grew up at the hands of itinerant African-American piano players, mainly in whorehouses and saloons around St. Louis. It spread along the river and then across the country. Improvised initially and then written down, given its form largely, though not exclusively, by the one ragtime name everybody knows, Scott Joplin. It became so popular the Tin Pan Alley songwriters picked it up. But most of them were not sophisticated musically. Most of them were not trained. They were cigar-chewing guys. They were not practicing poesy. They were not educated in conventional ways. What they heard was syncopation, and they put that syncopation into their songs so successfully that syncopation was one of the defining elements of the American song for many years. And they began to write lyrics about ragtime and about dancing to ragtime. And that's all it took to have a ragtime song. And so here was this new kind of song spreading all over the country. And in the midst of it all, because the ragtime songs go back to the turn of the century. Bill Bailey is 1902, I believe. Irving Berlin emerges. He writes his first song in 1907. It's not a ragtime song. It's an ethnic song that is truly generic, Marie from Sunny Italy. And he was told to write it by his employer because he had made a practice as a singing waiter at the Pelham Bay Cafe down in Chinatown. Of inventing naughty lyrics to the songs of the day, and the crowd liked it. And so when it was time to when Mike Salter wanted a lyricist to go with the music, he turned to Izzy Berlin. He hadn't changed his name yet. And that was another accident, but I don't want to do a biography. And so the first song, 1907, and 4 years later, that's all, we get Alexander's Ragtime Band. It wasn't the first ragtime song, but it was just late enough to reinvigorate the form and keep it going, give it new legs, new life, so that it continued into the next decade, right up through World War I. And it also fueled something called the dance craze, which was very raffish and irreverent and not quite respectable, even though it was really just the one step and the two step with an edge. And then they were made respectable by some people that Mr. Berlin worked with, Vernon and Irene Castle, because they taught those naughty dances to people like Mrs. Rockefeller and Mrs. Vanderbilt, and if they were doing them, then it was okay, you see, for your mother to let you do them. Irene was the most important female tastemaker of her time. When did women start to bob their hair? 30s. Everyone agree? No. Yes. Most people, in fact, I'm surprised, most people would say the 20s. because we think of when Bernice bobs her hair, the Fitzgerald story, we think of the 20s. But Irene Castle bobbed her hair in the teens, and millions of women followed suit. She took off her corsets in the teens because she was a dancer. They were also bloody uncomfortable. She wanted to be free to move, and the hourglass figure came to an end because Irene Castle, she was unintentional. She was a bit of a Westchester doyen. She wasn't out to change the world, but she did. She was an unintentional revolutionary in blue chiffon. And she danced. And she danced the dances that the ragtime songs were for. She also did a book with her husband called Modern Dance that I recommend to you. Do you know if it's in the collection? It's unlikely, I would think. Every other chapter is by Vernon, who, by the way, Fred Astaire modeled himself on, and understandably so. He was tall with long arms and pointy features, you know, a kind of an Ur Astaire. And Vernon wrote chapters on how to dance. There was a chapter on dancing the foxtrot with the little diagrams, you know, with your foot going this way and then your foot going that way. And the interchapters were by Irene, how to dress, how to walk, how to hold yourself when you danced, and why dancing was desirable. She taught millions of women that dancing was good exercise, that it was healthy, that it was enjoyable, it gave good pleasure, and here's the kicker, it was moral. Because if you were on the dance floor with your man, he was not in a gin mill somewhere. You need to understand, this is 1915 or so. Vernon died in 16 or 17. He was in the Royal Canadian Air Force, and there was a crash. In the second half of the 19th century, the most serious social problem in America was alcoholism. So that the suffragists, who were what we would call to the left of center, and the Anti-Saloon League and the Women's Christian Temperance Union, which was to the right of center, they didn't use those words, joined forces because of alcoholism in America. A working man starts to drink, he loses his job. You can fill in the story from there. Taking in washing didn't cut it. Families came apart, people died of starvation. And so saying that it would prevent men from drinking was still a powerful idea in 1916. She had an enormous effect on America. They began their career, by the way, in a small Paris nightclub when they were just about out of money. They were broke. They got this job. And every night at midnight, a spotlight in this dive. Now, in the movie, The Story of Vernon and Irene Castle, it's not a dive. It's a nightclub worthy of Fred and Ginger. It wasn't. It wasn't even worthy of you and me. I mean, it was a joint. A spotlight. They would sit at ringside, and just on the dot of midnight, a spotlight would pick out Vernon and Irene, and they would stand and they would do their one step. They would glide onto the floor to dance to a song that had already swept America, a ragtime song, and I thought you would like to hear that song that they danced to.
Meter man, oh my honey. churches, like a chicken, and the clarinet is a color pet. Come and listen to a classical band. What's peaches come now somehow? Better hurry along. Come on in here, come on in here. Alexander's ragtime band. Come on in here, come on in here. It's the best band in the land. They can play a bugle call like you never heard before. So natural that you want to go to war. That's just the bestest band, whatever. Oh, my honey lamb, come on along, come on along. Let me take you by the hand. Up to the man, who's the leader of the band. And if you care to hear the Swanee River played in ragtime,
now, I said that the ragtime songs were controversial, as were the ragtime dances. Of course, the waltz had been a controversial dance, and when the upper classes took it on, they tamed it. And now what was going to happen with ragtime dancing? Because dance schools were very popular at the time, and a fair number of teachers in these schools refused to teach the ragtime dances, which were also known, by the way, as the animal dances. You may know something I don't know. The turkey trot, the chicken scratch, the camel walk, the bunny hop, and nearly 100 more, including the grizzly bear. The foxtrot is actually not one of them, even though it's from that time. That's another story. Oh, thank you for doing that. Oh, there was a dancer, a song and dance man named Harry Fox, who was in the Ziegfeld Follies, and he had a specialty number in which he did a dance that with a number of running steps that was known as Fox's Trots, and that's where the foxtrot got it. So it looks like an animal dance, but it's not. There's a wonderful story about the grizzly bear, and then Sarah's going to sing that one and another one of Irving Berlin's ragtime songs. That's, in effect, selling ragtime songs. Remember, they are raffish dances. They're not quite respectable. And up in Boston, the home of respectability, I hear. A group of young people was arrested one night for dancing too energetically, shall we say, to ragtime, to the grizzly bear. And so they were hauled into court, and they hired a lawyer, and there was a jury. And in the course of the defense, the lawyer for the young people asked if he might sing the song for the judge to demonstrate that it was harmless. Out in California, where there's weather's fair, they got a dance out there, you know, they call the grizzly bear, that's the one. And the judge agreed. And so the lawyer stood up and began to sing. Within 8 bars, every member of the jury was singing the song, and the judge threw the case out of court. Ragtime had established itself. And the little icing on that cake is that a man named George Botsford, who was a minor writer of rags, not ragtime songs, had written something called Grizzly Bear Rag. It was a flop. He and Berlin were together one day, I don't know how or where or why, and they agreed somehow that Berlin would put lyrics to it. And Doing the Grizzly Bear became a great hit song. And Berlin then said that for a song to be, I don't have the exact quote, for a song to be complete, for a song to register, that may have been one of the words he uses, for a song to register, if not, it's a good choice, it needs words. Although, you know, the old story about Jerome Kern and Oscar Hammerstein, and somebody approaches one of their wives and starts praising Kern, their score to Showboat, and finally says, "An Old Man River is the best song anybody ever wrote." And I think it was Mrs. Kern. Poor Mrs. Kern has not been able to get a word, and this has gone on for a while. And she says, "Thank you very much. That's very nice, except my husband didn't write Old Man River. Oscar Hammerstein did." And the man gets red in the face and starts to apologize, and she says, "No, no, no, that's perfectly all right. Oscar Hammerstein wrote Old Man River. My husband wrote Dum, 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 Dum." You need the words. So here are the words and music to The Grizzly Bear and Everything in America is Ragtime. I have to interrupt to say something. It's so wonderful. The song is a combination of sexiness, of true love. He's anticipating marriage, and humor. It's a funny song. And one of the things the American songwriters of these years did, and Berlin was right there with people like Ira Gershwin, who also did it wonderfully well, they did something you're not supposed to be able to do. They combined wit and sentiment in the same lyric, in the same 32 bars. Sentiment, feeling, put you up close to something. Wit requires distance so you can arch that eyebrow and tell the truth about what's there. And they managed, through this gift of economy and inventiveness, within something that was familiar and conventional, to wed the two in extraordinary ways. I don't understand. I mean, I see the results, but the mindset is what eludes me. I continue, after all these years of working with stuff, to be dazzled by it. I'm sorry, I got in the way of your singing, but I don't want to lose that. Thank you.
composers just as thick as bees, writing raggy melodies. They're even making Gabby Deslys sing ragtime.
Those songs are hard to sing. Are you aware of how many syllables are crammed in to those things? It was the way songs were written. And Berlin and all the other songwriters would have to learn as time passed and styles changed. They didn't have to learn, but they did learn how to do it without jam-packing everything. And what we end up with as a result, songs like Always, songs like Remember, and What'll I Do, and my favorite of that group of slow ballads from the 20s, How About Me. If you don't know How About Me, go find it. It's an exquisite song. We all know Remember. We all know What'll I Do. It's their part. There are five of them. Remember, What'll I Do, How About Me, Always, and I don't know which one I left out. All Alone, thank you. Right. And the one that I'm especially fond of is the, and maybe it's because it's the least well-known, because I love all of them. Anyway, I'm now going to make you cringe, I'm afraid. This is the tough part of the program. I have to talk about something that's difficult to talk about. And that is that Irving Berlin's Alexander's Ragtime Band has many kinds of songs, and I'll touch on that. One of the kinds of songs it is a coon song. Coon, C-O-O-N. Coon song. The coon song derives from, but is not identical to, the songs of the minstrel shows of the 19th century. Ethnic songs were very popular in America between around 1890 and 1920. The minstrel show is dying. Minstrel songs are going with them, and the coon song replaces them, in effect. And songwriters write them because they're very popular. They are ostensibly, they're songs written by white songwriters mainly, to be sung by white performers, often in blackface, in a broad African-American dialect, Southern dialect. They are degrading, they are offensive, and the language is such that we choose not to use it publicly. And most of us prefer not to think it privately. They're difficult to talk about, and yet they're part of our history, and we cannot turn aside from them. What's fascinating about them, even though they're caricatures, and even though the caricatures offend us, is that at the same time that they are these things, nothing is simple, especially when you get to race in America, nothing is simple. And what you get in coon songs are the songs that make you want to hide under the bed. But you also get a range of things. You get songs which do their job. That is, they involve the elements that the coon song requires. But there's not the kind of amused nastiness that there is in some. They're much less venal. More importantly, in some of them that use the accent, because that's required, you can't write a coon song that doesn't use the accent in the composition, there are portraits of black characters in the songs that are not caricatures. There's a song from around 1916, not by Irving Berlin, and I'm choosing the title because it's as offensive as any I know, so hang on. It's called Mammy's Little Pumpkin-Colored Coon. See what I mean? And I chose it because your first response has to be, my God, how could people write that? How could people, where do I go to hide? Again, where do I go to hide? It was a time when there were many songs written about mothers. There were a lot of mother songs. And what the mother songs do is humanize mothers in the sentimental way. You know, M is for the many, O is, you know the kind of song I'm talking about. Well, in this ostensible caricature, the African-American mother is also treated in a sympathetic way, because here she is in the rural South, alone and poor, and yet her love for her baby is profound. And so where we expect to find a caricature, a stereotype, and nothing more, a self-celebrating, a circular caricature, it breaks, and what we've got is a view of a mother who loves her baby, who happens to be an African-American woman rather than somebody else. And so part of what's unsettling about these songs is not that they're offensive. I mean, they are, and it is unsettling. But what's the surprise is that in some of them, there's something else. And I would argue that that humanity that so surprises us in these songs is part of Alexander's Ragtime Band. In its view of Alexander, who is an African-American songwriter, that's part of what makes it a coon song. In 1911, for a black man to have a name like Alexander would have been considered highfalutin. There are lots of Alexander songs from the time, and they're all that kind of song. They're all coon songs. There's also some of the dialect. That's just the bestest band, what am my honey lamb. But the view of the people, the man who's talking to his girl, come on, he's trying to get her to go to this dance and go up and meet Alexander. That's what's going on in there. Hey, let's go out and have this great time dancing, and I'll introduce you to Alexander, who's the best musician in town. What's going on between them and the view of the woman that I'm going to talk about later, and the view of Alexander, who's up there and leading it and on at the top of his game, gives us a picture that's not nasty, that accepts these people at face value. It doesn't make them into saints. It lets them be people. And that's what coon songs typically don't do. And so it is a coon song, but of a kind that's way over to one end, or maybe right smack in the middle where we notice it. And by the way, even black songwriters wrote coon songs. Why? If you wanted to write songs and get them published, you had to write what the public would buy. And coon songs were very popular. And so people, wonderful songwriters like James A. Bland, who was the first important American songwriter who was an African American. You know his songs. Some of you know Golden Wedding. Some of you know Golden Slippers. And you all know Carry Me Back to Old Virginny. Did you know a black songwriter wrote that? Did you know another black songwriter wrote the Charleston? You would have to sit here if James Johnson didn't write the Charleston. You wouldn't be able to get up and kick your knees around. Bob Cole, Will Marion Smith, James Weldon Johnson, who wrote God's Trombones, that book-length poem, wrote songs, among them, coon songs. It's what the market would bear. We've got to do some. And I've tried to pick two that are relatively restrained. And to reinforce the point I just made, they're both by African-American songwriters. One is called Under the Bamboo Tree, which I first learned when Judy Garland and Margaret O'Brien sang it in Meet Me in St. Louis and did a cakewalk to it. And the other one is by is called Dark Town Is Out Tonight. Its songwriter, its lyricist, is an important African-American poet named Paul Lawrence Dunbar, who also wrote song lyrics and was associated with the loosely with the Harlem Renaissance.
Down in the jungle lived a maid of royal blood, though dusky shade. A marked impression once she made upon a Zulu from Matabulu. And every morning he would be down underneath the bamboo tree, awaiting there his love to see. And then to her he'd sing. If you like me like I like you, and we like both the same, I like, say, this very day, I like, change your name. 'Cause I love you and love you true, and if you love me, to live as one under the bamboo tree. And in this simple jungle way, he wooed the maiden every day by singing what he had to say. One day he seized her and gently squeezed her, and then beneath the bamboo green, he begged her to become his queen. The dusky maiden blushed unseen and joined him in his song. If you like me like I like you, and we like both the same, I like, say, this very day, I like, change your name. 'Cause I love you and love you true, and if you love me, one lives two, two lives one, under the bamboo tree. This little story, strange but true, is often told in Matabu, of how this Zulu tried to woo his jungle lady in tropics shady. Although the scene was miles away, right here at home, I dare to say, you'll hear some Zulu every day gush out this soft refrain. If you like me like I like you, and we like both the same, I like, say, this very day, I like, watch that pair. They don't care how they lift their feet. Gracious me, Julius Heap never could be beat. Where's that lies? A surprise. Reckon she can't come. Never know her so slow. Join in the fun. Yonder's lies with her sighs. What's he spec to do? Needn't grin, she can't win. Found she'd walk with you. Bless the lamb, here comes Sam with Clorinda too. Now's the time, get in line, show what you can do. For there'll be warm coons a-prancing, swell coons a-dancing, tough coons who wanna fight. So bring along your blazers, fetch out your razors, Dogtown is out tonight. Warm coons a-prancing, swell coons a-dancing, tough coons who wanna fight. So bring along your blazers, fetch out your razors, Dogtown is out tonight.
One of the more interesting things about Alexander's ragtime band, I've started to talk about this, I think, is its attitude toward women. Women in the second half of the 19th century, as you know, were supposed to be passive, obedient, domesticated, if not domestic. They possessed, obviously, a finer nature. But there was also something, at least in songs, enervated about them. In songs like Beautiful Dreamer, where the sleep is like death. In songs like Bird in the Gilded Cage, where the young woman marries for wealth, not love, and spends her life in a gilded cage, wasting away. But songs like Alexander's Ragtime Band change that. And it's not the only one, but it's one of the first. 6 years later, we had a song that did the same kind of thing called Darktown Strutter's Ball. You know, let's go. Encouraging the woman to be not a butterfly. Don't sit against the wall. Get up on your feet and square your shoulders and go out there and do it. We're going to meet Alexander and we're going to dance the night away. Let's go. Encouraging a woman to be up on her feet and doing the new dances as energetically as her partner. It had officially become okay for a woman to break a sweat. That doesn't mean that romance had disappeared. It does mean that new attitudes toward love were appearing in songs in the first decades of the 20th century. This is before the 20s. This is before the 20s. New ways of seeing and thus singing about romance and independence and sex and marriage. And remember that love really means three things, especially in songs. Well, maybe in life too. Romance, sex, marriage, or some combination. I hear occasionally they do go together. And so we're going to do three songs, one of which is by Mr. Berlin, that express some of the attitudes toward love at the time.
Girl, since I met a certain girl. descendant. My star is in the ascendant. That's why I don't care. I don't care. I don't care what they may think of me. I'm happy, go lucky. Men say I am plucky, so jolly and carefree. I don't care. I don't care if I do get the mean and stony stare. But I don't care. They say they don't like me a bit, but I don't care. 'Cause my good nature effervescing is one there is no distressing. My spirit there is no oppressing, just 'cause I don't care. I don't care. I don't care if people don't like me. I'll try to
That song is from 1912. Things change fast sometimes, yes. By 1920, recordings have become established. They're replacing sheet music. The music business is changing. Radio is coming. It was a new age of home entertainment for solitary listeners. The new singing style of crooning is not far down the road, in which a radio whispers intimately to you, at least so it feels. Single young women were moving to the city, huge numbers of them. You know, there was this great movement after the Civil War that continued for 60 or 70 years. A lot of the people who came to the city were young, a lot were single, and a surprisingly large number were women. And they wanted to hear something more personal and more intimate than the ragtime songs. As usual, Irving Berlin's antennae were keener and quicker than anybody else's. And by 1921, he'd written his first hit in this new style called All By Myself. It was also one of the first songs for which recordings outsold sheet music. But nearly a decade earlier, he'd written his first important ballad and one of his most personal songs. In other words, Berlin had been writing all these ragtime songs, and he was moving now into ballads, where every songwriter eventually must go. This is an extraordinary story. Berlin had married a young woman named Dorothy Goetz, whose brother was E. Ray Goetz, a songwriter whom he knew. He's best known for writing the lyrics to For Me and My Gal, which you could sing, another one of those songs where you can still sing every word, including the verse. You know, ding, dong, ding, dong. And he met Dorothy Goetz. That's another wonderful story, but there isn't time, how he met her. And they married, and she became ill, and less than a year after they married, she died. It had a devastating effect on Berlin. He was so deeply saddened by it. And he stopped writing. And for Irving Berlin, that was more than one should have to bear. He was unable to write. In fact, E. Ray Goetz, who was a good friend, trying to shake him out of this, took him to Europe to try, you know, the American cure, take them to Europe. Didn't work. When he came back, after a period of time, he began to work again. And when he did, there was a kind of explosion, as if it had been pent up in him. And the first two songs he wrote after he started writing again were When the Midnight Choo-Choo Leaves for Alabama, one of his great ragtime songs. And this ballad, his first major ballad, and one of his most personal songs, in which his grief at the loss of Dorothy he expresses. But what's fascinating to me all these years later, 100 years later almost, is that he expresses it within the conventions of the popular song, because it's, by this time, it's part of his DNA. It's what he knows, what he turns to. And so you're going to hear When I Lost You and All By Myself.
The sunshine had fled, the roses were dead.
The wonderful thing about a Morris chair is that you're sitting in it all alone. There's always room for somebody else. I know three recordings of When I Lost. What, is there anyone here who had never heard When I Lost You before? You're all familiar. One of you're all familiar with it. Oh, bless you. You're my kind of people. I know three recordings of it that I think are very good. Ann Hampton Calloway, who's a wonderful singer. Tony Bennett does it a cappella. And my very favorite, and this will surprise you, I think, Jimmy Durante. He can sing love songs. Ever heard his As Time Goes By and September Song? Oh, they're wonderful. The arrangements are kind of schmaltzy, but they sound like bad 1950s. But he really gets to the heart of a song. I recommend that you find it. Maybe iTunes has it. I don't know. But Jimmy Durante singing When I Lost You. Anyway, in 1914, Irving Berlin wrote his first Broadway score, complete score, not interpolations, for a show called Watch Your Step. And there's a new book coming out in May that apparently argues that Berlin plays a much more important role in the history of the American musical theater. You know, everybody says, oh, of course, Annie, get your gun, and everybody moves on. But that he does play a central part in the history of the musical, and the book is going to make that case. I've pre-ordered my copy from Amazon. It comes out in May. What's significant about this score, aside from some very good songs, is that it's the first time a score consisting mainly of ragtime songs was heard on Broadway. Songs from the saloon are now in a Broadway musical. Remember that Broadway musicals historically are conservative, very conservative. So if the musical is inviting ragtime in, it had proved itself to the larger public and was acceptable on stage. And so here are two of Berlin's songs written for the Broadway stage, only 3 years after Alexander's ragtime band flipped American taste on its ear.
On the grand piano. Morning, noon, and night, you'll find him picking rags. I don't mean the kind of rags you put in bags. He doesn't own a junk shop, just the same. He's a rag picker, all the live long day. He bangs upon the piano keys in search of raggy melodies. Nobody can. Most any time of the day,
What's nice about that is that she picked up the sexiness. Tommy Tune does a version. It's a video. I don't know quite what it is, but it's a video. And, you know, he's long. He's about 18 feet tall. He's a snake. He's got no bones. And he is all over that piano. He makes love to the piano as he sings the song. It's very funny. And it's right in the spirit of the song. So it's wonderful. Anyway, we're going to do one last song for you, and that's going to wrap it up. In the same show, Watch Your Step, Berlin wrote what musicologists call contrapuntal duets. He called it a double song. You take two melodies that fit together. You know what I'm talking. You do one, then you do the other, and then you do them both at the same time. Other songwriters did them. Frank Lesser, George and Ira did one, but no one did as many as Irving Berlin, and no one did them. You got it. Did you hear what she said? She said as well. She's right. There's one in his first Broadway score, and he did four or five more, and there's one in his last important show. His last important show, last great success, was Call Me Madam. I hear singing and there's no one. His last famous double song. What's nice about this one, the first one, is that not only was it a hit, but it was a hit again in the 50s when Bing and Gary Crosby sang it. And songs don't often get to be hits twice. Most don't get to be hits once. And the other thing I like about it is that there's a kind of implied history of American music in it. The first half, the first melody, first of all, it's about music. The song itself is about music. And the first melody is rather sweet and conjures up the 19th century sentimental ballad. And then the second melody is ragtime. And so you get a kind of history as you go from one melody to the second. It's like having Stephen Foster and Scott Joplin in the same song. It's kind of nice. My problem with it is that when I hear it, I want to be, and yet, you know, the two melodies go together. I want to be able to sing both at the same time, and I've been working on that for years and not getting very far with it. Your problem is that with all these extraordinary Irving Berlin songs to choose from, we've barely dipped our toes in the Berlinian waters, and we've more than run out of time. So thank you for coming, and please consider this song a kind of thank you gift for your wonderful attention today.
Rags and coony dregs, oh, made my poor heart ache.
Thank you. I'm about to pull a fast one. They don't know about this. I didn't know about it until I was listening. Do you want to sing?
Yeah.
You want to, you all know that song. All right. What's the first line?
Of the chorus?
Yeah, just the chorus.
Won't
you play a simple melody? Musical demon sets 100. Won't you play me some rag? Right? You all got it? You all know it? Ready? I am not going to conduct you.
Won't you play a simple melody and set that classical merry mind sound to me?
Rehearsal tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Thank you. And if anybody would like to buy the book, I will be happy to sign it. I believe they're downstairs.